You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
For African peoples, nothing important happens without a libation. And so for this very important presentation, we begin by the pouring of libation. We pour libation first to our first ancestor, to that hidden one who, though hidden, manifests in all things as all things, that God-goddess idea in the universe by any and all names. To our first ancestor, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation too to our ancestors because they were the first people on this planet, mothers and fathers of all mankind, flashpoint of the human family. To those ancestors we pour libation, Ashe. pour libation to our ancestors because they were the ones who first gave birth to the idea of civilization, knew we would need a form of governance, and they nurtured that idea along the Nile until it reached its zenith in Kemet. There they built these gigantic monuments as evidence of that great civilization, and they carved instructions on the walls of temples and tombs for us so we would never forget. To those ancestors, we pour libation. Ashe. Pour libation to our ancestors because over time they put together all the tenets of civilization and they took those ideas and left the continent. They were the people of the first Exodus. They left Africa and went all over the world and peopled the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation. Ashe. We pour libation to our ancestors because they did not sit on their laurels. They continued to improve, continued to evolve, and at each point of evolution, they again would leave the continent and settle and resettle the planet. They met themselves coming and going. To those ancestors, we pour libation. Ashe. Pour libation to those ancestors because over time, they found themselves the object of a forced exodus. When they were kidnapped, shackled, cargoed, shipped out of Africa and enslaved in diasporas around the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation. Ashe. Pour libation to the ancestors left at home, the very young, the aged, the infirm, left to reinvent themselves, depleted of us, human resources. But they were enjoined by us in the diasporas, both objects of a global myopia that ruptured the soul of a people as it ravaged a continent. To those ancestors, we pour libation. Ashe. Pour libation to those ancestors because over time they began to remember who and what they were. Because no matter where they had been dropped off, they still retained bits and pieces of who and what they were. They retained that African core that described them. They began to remember bits and pieces of a song. They began to remember lines from a rhythm. They began to remember dances that they did in ancient times. They began to remember those ancient drum beats that they now beat out on bare skin. And so to those ancestors, we pour libation. Ashe. Pour libation to them because they then began to teach each other. They began to resurrect and reconstruct that history and that culture. They became the new Africans wherever they were. They became the new teachers, preachers, archaeologists, the new singers, dancers, the new drummers, the new Jalia. They reconstructed that history and our culture and became new Africans everywhere. So to those ancestors, we pour libation. Ashe. Pour libation to those ancestors because they are the ones who passed that information on to us. And so we pour libation to those of you who will watch this presentation, those of you who are the recipients of that pieced together history, of that reconstructed culture. To you, we pour libation. Ashe. Pour libation to our children and those yet to be born, for they are the ones that you must teach, and you can only teach if you know the history. So to you who are learning the history and are passing on that history, and to our children who are learning that history and will pass that history on to all eternity, for they will call your name in all eternity. To our children we pour libation. Ashe. Ashe. Asheo.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
Finley Medical Clinic. We serve uninsured, underinsured, and insured individuals. open Monday through Thursday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Urgent care clinic Friday and Saturday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Call for an appointment at 414-988-3079. Findlay Medical Clinic is accepting new patients. Vaccines and screenings for uninsured, underinsured, and insured. Located at 10721 West Capitol Drive, Suite 110. Call our office for an appointment today.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Hotep and greetings, my sisters and brothers. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, Dr. William Rogers. So pleased to have you with us here this evening. We have a very special program with a very special guest that we are going to be talking with in just a few minutes. We are here every Tuesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time, right here on the Time for an Awakening radio platform. The Black Reality Think Tank hosts three other programs as well, and we'll talk about those a little later at the top of the hour. But we are so happy to be involved in this endeavor, and we thank you for your patience. We do not take it lightly, and so we hope that you will continue to listen to our programs and enjoy those like you were here tonight. Also, I want to remind you that this is a call-in format. If you wish to participate in the conversation or ask a question, you can do so by calling area code 215-490-9832. And I'll repeat, 215-490-9832. I am not going to waste any time. We're going to get ready to get into this conversation with our very, very special guest. It is a pleasure for me, on behalf of the Black Reality Think Tank radio broadcast family, to welcome Miss Tiffany Drayton, who is the author of a very, very, very powerful treatise entitled Black American Refugee, Escaping the Narcissism of the American Dream. A powerful piece. Good afternoon, Ms. Drayton. How are you? Oh, just a second, Ms. Drayton. I'm sorry. There was some noise coming in the background, and I had to turn the mics off for a minute. Okay, now, good afternoon, Ms. Drayton. How are you doing?
I'm quite fine. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, indeed. I appreciate you so much. Let me just tell our audience a little bit about Ms. Drayton. Ms. Tiffany Drayton is, first of all, a mother, which is the number one duty of all. She is a traveler, a world traveler, and a journalist whose work has been featured in the New York Times, Vox, Marie Claire, Playboy, Salon, and Complex. And she's also been on Yahoo, among other outlets. She has published two nonfiction young adult books called Developing Political Leadership Skills and Coping with Gun Violence. She grew up in the United States and currently lives with her family in Tobago. After following her mother to the U.S. at a very young age to pursue economic opportunities, one woman must come to terms with the way in which systematic racism and resilient trauma keep the American dream inaccessible to black people. Amen. Reviewers and critics have indicated that Ms. Drayton's book is the most anticipated book of February. And this was done in Essence, Marie Claire, and the AV Club. This work is a welcome addition to the literature on race in America. Ms. Drayton has a powerful story, and she has the voice to do it justice. The conversation is going to be tonight about her book, and we are going to get into it. We want you to purchase her book. It is to be released on 1 week from today, February the 15th. And we are so happy that we are able to introduce that to our audience. And we highly, highly encourage you to get a copy of this book and make sure that you enjoy this powerful message. I was very fortunate to get a copy of it, obviously before its release date, based on the reviewing of the book. And I have truly, truly enjoyed it. And so we're going to talk about that book tonight and some other things in relationship to the points that she makes in this book, and just learn a little bit more about some of the things that she's going to do and has done, and get a chance, if you like, to ask her some questions or just, as I said, participate in this conversation. So we really appreciate this so much. So, Ms. Drayton, are you ready?
I'm absolutely ready.
Okay, great. I really did. Again, I really do appreciate you being able to reach out to you, and you answered me so quickly. I thank you. That's very important. It means a lot. You know,
people.
Right, right. You know, when I first encountered your book, and it was coming out, it actually was done in the New York Times. That's where I saw it. And I missed the essay you had there, and I had to go back and find it and get it. And I don't know why, because I read the Times all the time, so I just did not see it. But I did go back, and I did get it, and I did read it. And I have been empowered, and we're going to talk a little bit about the essay as well. But there's two things about your book that really struck me of interest. One was your use of the term refugee. And number two was the fact that you are following in the path of a very powerful tradition of writers. The Trinidadian Tobago writers are some powerful brothers and sisters, and their works ring throughout the discourse of African-American life. And I'm talking about people such as C.L.R. James, for instance, Dr. Eric Williams, Oliver Cromwell Cox, Sylvester Williams, George Padmore, and the likes of that. And by all means, one of my favorite writers, Derek Walcott. And as I said, you follow in that powerful tradition of Trinidadian writers. And as I see, people love your work. And these were award-winning, Nobel Prize-winning folk. And I truthfully believe you are on the way as well. So let me ask you, by starting off, did any of these writers influence you in your work?
My work is mostly influenced by African-American writers, and specifically the poetry of Maya Angelou, which kept me alive, I would say, during hard times and during darkness. Nonetheless, the thoughts of Eric Williams and also even the poetry of Derek Walcott, both of these, I would say, thought leaders have been very crucial to me in how I orient myself in this world and in this Western hemisphere then. So while it's not just their writing that's influential for me, it's really listening to their speeches and reading their poetry. That has really been great for me too.
Yeah, and Derek Walcott's poetry is powerful. I had a very good friend that lived in New York at the time I lived in New York, and she was Trinidadian, and we used to talk a lot about some of the stuff, and that's how I got into Derek Walcott. I read his book, Dream on Monkey Mountain, and I was blown out of the water when I read that book. And actually, you know, I used it in a lot of my classes during my teaching years at the university. And it's a powerful piece. And then even his daughter, Elizabeth Walcott Hackshaw, who is also a powerful writer as well. And so, like I said, you come in the shadows of some very, very heavy folk. And I can,
you know, and it's really very interesting because I've been currently working on my next book, and I was looking for inspiration for this next book. Specifically, I already had a theme going.
Okay.
And when I Googled some keywords to kind of draw out some searches that would help me find that inspiration, Derek Walcott's poetry on like the underworld, I forget what it's called, came up. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. It looks like we're thinking about a lot of the same things.
Yeah. And you know, also what I found interesting, a lot of the book that you've done, I was also interested, even though I know he's a Hindu and Indian, V.S. Naipaul.
Yes,
his writings, but particularly in a book that he wrote where he's talking about an area, a part of town, and all of the things that they're going to. And his writing and your writing are very similar, particularly in the way that you express that and the way he expressed it. You do it very colorful, and so did he. And I've thought about that, and I want to talk about that too as a part of your doing. We'll get into that part later. But I guess the real kickoff question is refugee. I remember during the Katrina, when the storm in New Orleans came, and one of the newspapers, and I don't remember which one, referred to the people that were leaving their homes because they had been wiped out as refugees. Now, these are American citizens who have been here, pay taxes, have jobs, and they refer to them as a refugee. So help me a little bit understand how to use that word and the proper usage of it, you know, as it relates to situations like what you went through and obviously something like Katrina.
Right. Well, of course, a refugee is essentially a person who is fleeing their homeland or their native land because they're in fear of their safety, just because of their race, because of their religion, et cetera, or their nationality or their membership in a particular group that's typically an oppressed minority. Mm-hmm. So when we think about applying that definition then to just all Black Americans, we recognize it's very easy to become a refugee in your own state, in your own city. And mm-hmm. we see that with things like gentrification, for example. We see that with the way that there's this policing that is so deadly and this deadly use of force by police. So this fear, this constant state of fear that Black people have to live in their own country, and also being driven out of your cities, of your towns with such frequency, just purely based on your race and how that stratifies you in the society, you can easily see how this term refugee can apply to African Americans who not only flee America, but who oftentimes have to flee their cities, their towns, in search of housing, in search of freedom from the police in certain areas.
Yeah, well, you know what? And as a matter of fact, you awakened me to that when I looked at the Katrina situation again. Because those were, if they would have been American citizens, they wouldn't have gone through what they went through in the way that they went through it, and had been recognized as that, you know. And so obviously they were.
I think Katrina was a really big wake up call for Black America, because here are people in desperate need in their own country, and you see this status of second class citizenry that's just very apparent and glaring in the way that they're disregarded and in the way that the government pretty much turned a bland eye. So the question is, well, what is our status in the United States of America as Black people?
That's exactly right. So, okay, so then with that, I understand very clearly why you named your book what you named it, American Refugee, and I think you were appropriate in doing so. And so with that, let's get into a little bit of it. We obviously, we want our audience and those that are listening to purchase the book. So we're not going to go into a whole lot of it, but we're going to go enough in it to sort of, to prick your consciousness and whet your taste a little bit so that you want to go out and get it. We definitely want to do that. So I'm going to start actually, in the prologue. There's just a couple of points I want to ask about. In your prologue that you talk about, you mentioned something about internalizing King's dream. And you said that was a part of your coming to the Americas, that you wanted to internalize that, and sort of you were prepared to do that. Could you explain that just a little bit for me?
Oh, absolutely. You know, Martin Luther King's vision and dream for the United States of America was that. It was a dream. It was something that he was aspiring to. But taken out of the context of reality and of history, white people have weaponized this dream to create this makeshift, like, fictional world where this dream is reality. And so when you go to a history class and, you know, you're a kid in school and you're sitting in your history class and you learn all about these awful things like slavery, and you learn about Jim Crow, and you learn about how Black people were really oppressed and enslaved even. But then, you know, the bow tie is, oh, but then Martin Luther came around and everybody's free and everything is great and everything is colorblind. But what we're not in is the actual reality that no. This was something he was fighting for. He understood that there was a long road to travel to get there, and that required not only the labor of black people, but the allyship of white people and all other people of color to make sure that we break down these barriers that oppress people of color and black people.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And, you know, we are learning more and more about King as time moves on, and that usually happens mm-hmm. anyway, particularly when you look at things in a polemic way. You know, it changes as you move forward. And very clearly, you know, even though he was pushing for integration, because that was the spirit of the time, was to move to integration mm-hmm. where you'd have better opportunities. But we clearly understand that just wasn't going to work here. And that was maybe right. the wrong approach to take. And, I mean, we're learning that. So we don't need to talk about that. But, you know, it's an understanding that, you know, why someone would consider a dream differently. You know, particularly you going to put so much into a fight to make things change. Yeah, so you're right. I like that. Let me ask you, okay, now I know that you were motivated by a lot of the things that you were seeing. So let me set the stage right first. You were in, as a young girl, you had gone, your parents and your family had gone to come to America, and you went to New Jersey, correct?
Correct, yes.
Right. Now, was that, I know you talked about Bergen. Was that Bergen, New Jersey?
Yeah, it was North Bergen, yeah.
North Bergen, okay, right. Because I was trying to think of that, you know, in my own years of living in New York, and I know that area, Bergen and Weehawken, New Jersey. And,
right, right.
Jersey City, and, you know, mm-hmm. and a lot of that's rough stuff over there. I mean, it is. And even to the point, I know there's a large Jewish community lives over there. And, you know, but I was there in the 70s. So, you know, I'm kind of mm-hmm. talking from that point. I know you were there in the 90s, so it might have changed a little bit. But I remember. And I remember they had a train that actually was built to go between Jersey and New York called PATH, right? Was it the PATH train?
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, PATH was designed to go from New York to New Jersey. So anyway, there's a lot of interaction in there. So what is it that motivated you to say, you know, I'm going to write a book about all of this? What specifically did that in your spirit? What turned your spirit to make you say that?
Well, I would say, you know, I would have to begin at the end. Well, not the end, but at the point at which I felt so compelled to write, which was, you know, when I was really an adult.
Okay.
So by the time I was in college, I went to college at the New School University, mm-hmm. and I took this awesome class with this professor named Derek Hamilton, and the class was called Racial Stratification in the U.S. Economy. Mm-hmm. And at the time, when I read the catalog, it was like, this class is going to dissect racism and explain, you know, how racism interplays with the U.S. economy, this, that, the other. And I'm like, what are they talking about? What racism? Mm-hmm, America's mm-hmm. the land of free. I had internalized so much of that messaging. And so now here I am, 20-something years old, and this man, every single class, just destroyed every single perception I had with all of the studies and the statistics and readings that were born of this era of scholarship that, you know, both himself and his mentor and all of the people of that era had really done such a fantastic job of really culminating for us. So that was the moment where I was like, this information and this rewiring of my own self, this mm-hmm. this reconfiguring of my black identity that's happening in this class, mm-hmm. from that point forward, that's what really ignited that flame to help do that for other people. Because I recognize it's not just a matter of external racism, like it's not just a matter of how we are oppressed by external forces, it's really how we internalize that oppression and do it to ourselves. So that's the point at which I decided this has to change. I have to say something or do something.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I can understand how that would hit you because of the fact that, you know, you're in an intellectual setting. You're looking to learn. Your mind is open. Mm-hmm. You're contemplating a lot of things, your own future. And then you've got this rabid kind of behavior that I'm sure that a lot of these those professors at the time had it. Because you were there in the 90s, correct?
No, I was in college in the 2000s.
Oh, 2000. Okay, that's okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And things.
I graduated 2013, so everything before that.
Okay. And basically, things have gotten definitely worse. They're deteriorating a lot. I remember in New York, they had City College. And a lot of African Americans had to go to City College. NYU was not open to accept blacks at that time. Just again, I'm talking the 70s and the 80s. They were not open, and definitely not Columbia. And that's out of the question, you know. And City College, it was having some real struggles, you know, with their black studies and all of those kinds of things. And so they had to hire some all-black professors. They hired Dr. John Henry Clark at City College for a while and some others, you know, in order to meet those demands. But those other universities that you're talking about, they weren't open. They weren't open to accept blacks at all. And so as a result.
Yeah, so it's really beautiful when you recognize that the scholarship that I was exposed to and all of these studies, how recent they were and how that was building on the legacy of people of the civil rights movement and people like MLK and everybody else who fought for civil rights. So just so it's clear, whether integration was a good long-term goal for us, it ultimately still led to the ability for us to access institutions that then birthed all of this amazing scholarship. So, you know, there's really no good answer to fighting an oppression. There's no good answer. There's committing yourself to the fight and doing it however you can at that time.
Okay. All right. And so in the prologue, you said at this time, you were, you know, obviously you're explaining to us about the book. You said that, you know, at that point, you're ready to leave America. And you said you were leaving not only to find freedom, you said, but first and foremost, you were looking at an intrinsic act of self-preservation.
Absolutely.
That's what you said.
And
I think that that is clear. In terms of making that decision to leave and what you were doing and how you were going to do that. I'd like to ask all of our listeners, please, if you could, remember if your mics are open, it can make noise as you move things around, so please mute your mics. I appreciate that. So you made the decision to leave. Was it a drastic kind of thing, or was it... a gradual process of getting out, you know, and I assume.
It certainly felt pretty drastic however, the feelings that kind of motivated that action were building for a long time because there's a kind of spiritual warfare that you're constantly enduring that takes a toll on you, and you're drained and you're exhausted. And you're tired. This is from the perspective of a young person. I was in my late teens, in my 20s, and I always felt like life was a drag. And I was just so exhausted of life. So those feelings that were just really weighing me down were a culmination of my life experience in this country for so long. So by the time I came to make that decision, like, you know what, I need to get the heck out of here, it was really a matter of me recognizing those feelings and how much they were weighing on me, and that weight could potentially be so harmful to me that I really needed to get out of that situation.
Okay. All right. So you said you were, and in the title of your book, it says that you are escaping the narcissism of the American dream. Explain that a little bit. And I like the fact that you use the word narcissism, but explain how that fits into this.
Yes, well, the aspect of narcissism and how I tie it into the book was really born of my interaction with my former partner and the man who's the father of my two kids. And I endured such an abusive narcissistic relationship with him right around the time that I was really trying to escape America and escape the abuses of America. And while enthralled in that cycle of abuse with him, I started pointing out and recognizing, like, wait a minute, this really feels like my relationship to America. And the more I sat down with that thought and applied my intellect to it, I recognized this perpetual cycle of abuse that you can see across history between the United States of America and black people. And at that moment, it was like this eureka moment, because, you know, we get so caught up in these moments of, for example, the election of Obama. I remember when Obama was elected, everybody was elated. And that was that moment where, especially the white liberal left, they were like, what do you mean racism? There's no such thing. It's over. Everything is good now.
Right.
And that's really, yeah, you know, and those moments where we have these gradual little changes, I refer to them as, when you're in an abusive narcissistic relationship, you have those moments of calm, mm-hmm. where you think, oh, well, he's going to get better. Everything is getting better. Yeah, I know it was really bad before, but right, look at this right. moment. It's so great. Right. So I started really being able to identify and qualify the many ways that my relationship to America pretty much mirrored my relationship to my narcissistic abusive ex.
Oh, interesting. That's really interesting. That's a, and, you know, you're right. I mean, for instance, in the Obama situation, I never really ever took that serious. I don't know. I kind of felt different, but I just didn't take it serious. I was glad he won. You know, I'm glad of that. You know, I guess I was glad of that, where he won. But, I mean, I knew that he couldn't do anything. I mean, because, first of all, he can't do anything. He wouldn't be there, and I knew that. And so they were selling us a pipe dream, like it always have done. And which is why your recognition of this in terms of the work that you're doing and have done in this book is being able to recognize that somebody is selling you a pipe dream. And
precisely.
And it's not what it is, what you think it is. You know, it's not. And as a result of that, you have to be aware. You have to make yourself aware of that. And America has done that for a long time. And, you know, we had some other writers that used to deal with that as well. One of the outstanding ones I remember was Amiro Baraka. He did one called The Dutchman, a play. And in The Dutchman, he was dealing with, it was, you know, symbolic, all, a lot of stuff. And it was about a black man on the train meets a white woman on the train. And she seduces him. And that whole act of that was America. America seduces black people. And it's a act of subduction. And once they seduce mm-hmm. you and do that, then they kill you. And
interesting,
right? And Baraka did that.
Mm-hmm. Abuse—that's like the first part of the cycle, which is in that context called love bombing, which is where you sell the person the perfect dream, and you sell the person the happily ever after story,
right?
And you sell them like how America would sell everybody this American dream and this idea that if you just work hard enough and meritocracy and all of these things, while simultaneously mm-hmm. beneath that superficial. Dream that they're selling, the reality tells you something far different. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's very similar.
Right, right. Now, I like also you said in the book, you say you were born part of a generation of black women who had that strength, the insight of our ancestors. You said they were freedom fighters, they were artists, they were intellects, they were scholars. And they had an understanding, you know, of who they are, I've always been a strong advocate of that group of women. Explain that a little bit for us. Who are some of the specifically that you were thinking about that motivated you in doing this? Because obviously, this book displays that tremendously.
You know, it's really interesting because as I wrote this book, it really gave me an opportunity to sit back and just even watch my own family. And my own family's history, mm-hmm. and watching the generational leaps that women in my family have taken to come from, I mean, how many generations away were we enslaved and illiterate? And here I am, a published writer, and it's often taken for granted because we don't acknowledge and appreciate how much of a fight one must have put up in order to make the gains that were made mm-hmm. to create that reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so my own family, like just watching the difference between my mother's outcomes and my grandmother's outcomes and my great-grandmother's outcomes, seeing all that they had to do and sacrifice just so I can have this outcome. It's just truly inspiring. And as I'm being inspired by this individual expression of this, like, this like black woman magic, right? All around me, it's blossoming, and you're seeing, you know, for example, there was a really big talk. Everybody's like, I don't think I'm voting for any president unless Michelle Obama, you know, mm-hmm. because there's this sense that, you know, black women are going to save us. And with good reason, because you're seeing, like, Stacey Abrams, what she did out in Georgia, you know, just so many inspiring black women that are really stepping up and taking the reins. And it doesn't even have to be on a huge national scale,
right.
even within communities.
In communities,
you know,
right.
We're just holding down the community. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you all are the womb. You are the womb. I mean, there's a lot of wisdom that says, even I know the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, the head of the Nation of Islam, he said 85% of his work is with the woman, because the mm-hmm. hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. And I believe mm-hmm. that, and I think that's really important. And when I look at the role that women play, you're right. So I'm glad you recognize
you look
it.
At,
uh-huh. Go ahead,
and
I'm
when
sorry.
You look at college education rates of black women, and even small business, who's opening small businesses, who's becoming college educated, who's reading books. You know, when I started stumbling on all of these studies, and it's like, wait a minute, one of the largest red demographic in the United States of America is actually college-educated black women.
Yeah.
We are really leading the pack. You want to know why? Because we feel that strain, and we understand that we must, and it's a matter of survival. And that drive, it's just, it's sad, but simultaneously it births this, like, this beautiful, just very powerful, and as a collective movement, like it really has created this movement that's just truly inspiring.
Right, exactly. And you know, Tiffany, I really believe this to the bottom of my heart. If we're going to resurrect our community, if we're going to rebuild, black men and black women have got to learn to work together. They really do. I mean, and we're not doing that in the way that we need to. We need to do it in a way that our children see it, and we'll look then in some cases to duplicate that. There's too much mm-hmm. domestic violence. There's too much friction, breakups, all kind of different things that just strain the black family. And particularly, it strains the mm-hmm. relationship between the man and the woman. That's all it is. There's a man and there's a woman. And then there's a creator of all of that. And we have destroyed, or have allowed to be destroyed, the very connection of human life itself. As a writer and as a black thinker, and one, and very clearly you are a thinker, a very powerful thinker, have you ever thought about that? And is there something that maybe you can add that maybe we need to do for our communities? Have you thought about it in that sense of things?
Of course, I think about it all the time. It's one of those pervasive thoughts for me, especially as a young black woman, because you realize that your life is intertwined with other black people, and specifically with black men, if you want to have a family. And with regards to answering this question of what we should be doing, I would say that's a huge question, but one of the most fundamental places we need to start is really taking back control of our narrative and how we view ourselves and our relationship to one another, and also grounding those narratives in reality. Because, you know, I was out the other day hanging out with a group of two black guys and another black woman, myself. We're at a bar, we're hanging out, talking. And mm-hmm. the young man, he begins his diatribe, and he says, you know, it's because black women refuse to submit, and that's why we have all of these out-of-wedlock births and this and that. And so, you know, there's this perpetual displacement of the dysfunction within the black community that's the result of all types of forces of oppression, and you name it, right?
Right.
And all of that is displaced onto the shoulders of black women, and that's absolutely ridiculous. So I would say there's a fundamental need for black men to stand and take positions of leadership in the community mm-hmm. that are not just a matter of, like, displacing responsibility and blaming women, but a matter of actually re-grounding a sense of masculinity and what it means to be a black man in this context in right. reality.
That's powerful. And you know, it's so difficult because sometimes even as we attempt to sit down and talk about it, we can't get 10 minutes into the conversation without, you know, the attacks coming about you. You're on to be the feminist and you this and, you know, you the over masculinity kind of stuff. And you get all of that going. And then very clearly, you know, social media is putting a big hit on the black family. Mm-hmm. A very big hit. And it's creating energy that I don't think is healthy for our children, you know, which number one. And as a result of that, you know, it's going to continue. So I think it's some. Now, let me ask you this, and I kind of diverted a little bit from your book, but I like what you said in there about, you know, the generation of black women that you follow. So I wanted to just, you know, pigtail off of that. How do you think we need to do that? Where does it need to be done? In the community, in churches, religious groups? How should we do that from your perspective?
All organizing around common goals is good organizing. And the reason why I stress common goals is because once there are common goals, ideology takes a back seat. Because we don't need to agree on religion, and we don't need to agree on the role of men and women or any of these things. Mm-hmm. We just need to agree on common goals. Do we want housing? Do we want to build those houses?
I got you. Mm-hmm.
Do we want sustainability? Do we want good education? And once we can agree that these are the fundamental values that we're striving towards, I think that that's more important and will allow these ideological conflicts to take a back seat, which is precisely where it belongs. In fact, it don't even need to be in the car. It mm-hmm. needs to just get thrown the hell out, because it's just senseless and pointless to be arguing ideology when we're in the midst of crises and crises on every level, whether it be economic crisis, whether it be health crisis, whether it be we're in crisis mode. And that's just a fact. So while we're arguing ideology and while people are twittering and whatevering about Nicki Minaj, guess what? The black community is crumbling even more so than before. We're facing rent hikes that are absolutely absurd. We're facing inflation that right. will make it harder for you to put food on the table. And then jobs are not paying properly. So the truth is we need to be organized around common goals,
yes.
more so around ideological arguments, which is precisely what is being driven by these social media platforms. It really focuses on dividing people by ideology, which is pretty smart when you think about it, you know, divide and conquer.
Right, exactly. And when we, I'm going to open up the lines in a few minutes to for our audience. We have many, many people that are on right now, and see if they have questions. We're going to do this right at the top of the hour. And then I wanted you to talk about comparing and contrasting this to Trinidad Tobago. You know, is what is it like there? You know, I mean, is that there? You know, I mean, you left to go back. But as I think about even the Caribbean and organizations like Caribicom, which is a collection, you all got all that gas and that oil, you know, and I bet you Europeans are up in that. Yeah, I know they are. So what has that done for you all? But anyway, I want you to talk about that because I really don't know, and I want to talk about that when we come back. But before we go on the break, I want to ask one more thing about the book in terms of what you did. Now, for those of you who were, we are talking to Miss Tiffany Drayton, by the way, for those who have just come on the line. She is the author of a wonderful book that we have been, you know, discussing, and we kind of, you know, going through some of the chapters and the particulars of it. It's called The Black American Refugee. Black American Refugee, Escaping the Narcissism of the American Dream. And it was due to be released on next Tuesday, 1 week from today. Everybody has it, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Audible has it, Kindle has it. And it's a powerful book. The New York Times has reviewed it. And some of the large services that do review books, and all of them have said that this is the next great piece of work in reference to looking at the African journey. And I'm pleased that we are able to have her on and talk about it because it fits right into the way I think about things as well. Okay, now let me ask about one of your chapters. In chapter one, you paint a real good picture about your mother and the community that you were moving into, and and what she was doing, and what your expectations were there as you were moving into the things after you had got here to America. And you know, you did explain a little bit to that to us. And for those who were on, we're talking about the New Jersey area, that's very close to New York, places like Weehawken, Jersey City. But she lived in Bergen, New Jersey. And we're talking about that. So I notice also, in terms of the way you describe that, you painted, if this was a painting, this would have real bright, nice colors in it. And you would have it as an illuminated piece of work. I've always believed that particularly the Trinidadian writers and those that were writing in the Caribbean could easily do that, because when you look out your window, there's nothing but sunshine, water, and green grass. Is that a factor? Sure. I mean, I know that might sound like a stupid question, but I really think that that has something to do with it. Is that a factor?
Oh, no, it's absolutely a fact. And in fact, I oftentimes say that in my writing when I compare my outlook and my view of the world through the lens of America, it's always very dark and very gray, and the colors are gray, black. And then, of course, when I return to Trinidad and Tobago, it's like everything is in like 4D, you know, like everything is super vivid and colorful and beautiful because everything. It's Caribbean island. Mm-hmm. So it's just, you know, whether it be the green mountains or the colorful flowers or, you know, the really pretty hummingbird or you name it, and even the colorful people, you know, right. That doesn't hurt as well. So it's like, for certain, I would say you gather a lot of inspiration and you're able to view the world with more color when you finally escape a place like, for example, where I was originally raised, in North Bergen, New Jersey. Though the upbringing was very, you know, it was one of those 90s kids upbringing where you leave your house when, you know, as soon as you get home from school, you do your homework, you run outside, you go play.
Right,
and you're safe.
Exactly.
And you go around the town and you're free to do that, you know?
Okay.
Yeah, so it was a really beautiful, colorful childhood as well. But of course, being able to describe that, it's easier for me because of my experience with the Caribbean as well.
And you know, the reason that I asked that particularly, because you did painted a part of New Jersey like that. Now, I've been to New Jersey, and I don't think New Jersey looks like that.
But it was totally like that for me. You know, it's funny because I always say, like, those first few years in America were pretty much the only years I was ever happy.
Okay.
And it was really because that town was such a safe haven in the way that not only it was accessible, right? You can walk everywhere by foot. Meaning all of the kids from the time you're 4 or 5 years old, you're walking to the elementary school, and that walk could be a 15-20 minute walk. And all of the kids are walking together to school.
Right.
And then it's like, you know, for lunch, you get to go out for an hour and just run around the town and play, you know, and you know all of the neighbors, and you know your pizza store guy, and you know, there was a video store guy back in the day who used to sell candy, and you'd go buy candy in the store, you know, so there was so much freedom for children in that environment because it was a very safe one. And I would say I never experienced that after, but at that time, it was definitely like that.
Because you painted and I will agree with this, the New York skyline is one of the most gorgeous viewpoints you've ever seen in your life. And you painted that really well. You painted that really well.
Especially to be an immigrant and to arrive and stumble upon that scene, it's literally the most, and that's part of the allure of this country.
Okay.
It has many of those visuals that inspire that feeling that you should be free. You know, you see the Statue of Liberty, and it's this huge thing on this waterfront with all these glistening, huge buildings. You're like, wait a minute, this could be mine too, you know?
Yep, that's true. You're right about that. I mean, it does have that allure to it. And and like you said, but we know it's not real. And I think even with Jersey, I remember only thing, I mean, I used to like Wildwood and Atlantic City, you know, because of the ocean and the beach and the boardwalk. And I remember that. But, you know, you're right. That's very important. And I think I just wanted to ask you that question. Now, the next mm-hmm. question I wanted to ask you, in chapter 6, you talk about healing. Okay, give us just a taste of that. Because like we said, we want folks to buy the book. So we want them to see, but I just want people to know, you know, that you have written this in a way that we can really gain from it. Just a little bit about healing, just for us, real briefly.
Right. So as I already kind of explained, the book likens the Black relationship to America to a narcissistic abusive relationship.
Right.
Now, at the point at which you recognize you're in an abusive relationship, well, guess what? You have to leave. And okay. So for myself, as I separated myself from the country, and not just physically, but intellectually and spiritually, and all of the lies that I was told, even mm-hmm. in a college class, being able to be exposed to reality and have to finally grapple with all of these things and recreate my identity, it really reminded me of the beautiful aspects of Black American history that always made me feel hopeful. Mm-hmm. And that's what that chapter is about. It's those moments of healing that even within this extraordinarily abusive relationship still shed light or act as like a beacon of light for us. And so that's what that chapter opens up on, all of these different examples of how we as a people have tried our best to heal from this abusive relationship
right.
despite every attempt to destroy us.
mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Now, you know what? I know exactly what you're talking about. Because I'll give an example.
I mean, tell just think about the 60s with the big froze and Black right. is Beautiful,
oh, love
Black
it.
Power,
love
and the disco dancing. Just
yes,
think about,
yes,
you know,
yes.
Whitney Houston and the 90s and the 80s and the music. And I mean, every era you can think about the beauty of the fashion and the poetry and all of these beautiful things that we've used to express our own identities, and that comes from that place of healing.
That's right.
Because only in our healing are we able to create things that truly reflect who we are.
Right. That's exactly right. Talking about Marcus Messiah Garvey heals me. If I'm being if I'm bruised, and I talk about it and get into that, it heals me. Fannie Lou Hamer heals me.
Mm-hmm.
It's like an altar. And You're right. You're right. So, yeah, good. Okay. All right. So folks, you definitely want to take a look at 6, because 6 has that thing that what we are talking about. And then, one of the things I like what you're doing, you're facing, you know, your trials in terms of the narcissistic behavior, because, you know, we are talking about male-female relationships again. And, and you had mentioned lethal abuse. And I know that I like the way you were pairing and contrasting that in this chapter. This is in chapter 8, lethal abuse. You want to say a few things about lethal abuse?
Oh, absolutely. Because, you know, this is the point at which we are arriving, really, in my opinion, in this cycle of abuse with Black America. So every single time a person tries to leave an abusive relationship, if they get ensnarled back in the relationship in return, the abuse escalates.
Right.
And that's really the danger. And that's when, you know, why often you see, you know, it's when the woman tries to leave the abusive relationship that the man comes and kills her.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, every single time Black people try to wrestle their freedom and their liberties back from America, that's when we see things like the bombing in Philadelphia. That's when we see these egregious attacks on our physical bodies and our safety.
Mm-hmm,
and so abuse paints that picture where, you know, just even for myself, as I'm trying to extricate myself from this relationship, both with my ex and with America, I'm realizing how much more dangerous it's getting for me
right.
and how the abuse is starting to escalate.
Right.
And so that's why, you know, the first part of the prologue when you were talking about me saying it was a matter of leaving for self-preservation, well, at that point, you realize literally you may not leave the situation with your life if you continue to operate in this way and participate in this relationship.
Mm-hmm. Powerful. Was your mate from Trinidad?
No, he's actually American, and his family is Haitian.
Okay, so that was a clash there, right there, because that's a history too. People from the Caribbean, the West Indians, and African Americans have had some stormy events there. I'm not saying anything that's secret. It's the history, even to the point that the African American scholar Harold Cruz wrote a book called "The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual." He talks about some of the friction of that West Indian African American relationship, and into that, and then even particularly in New York, but during the Harlem Renaissance in those areas, and that has carried over. I'm sure it hadn't gone anywhere. So,
that's actually a big part of my I would say one of the only Twitter feuds I am persistently embroiled in is with a group called ADOS, which is essentially a group of African American people who say who are fighting for reparations, but right. they want to exclude everyone else from having the reparations. They attack immigrants and whoever else for speaking about racism or for trying to raise issues of racism. So it's ongoing. And now, of course, this isn't to paint immigrants or black immigrants as the victim. Of course, they're participants as well. So everybody has, you know, this role and that conflict that we continue to engage in. As I said before, it's a matter of just divide and conquer and watching it perpetuate throughout, you know, different eras. It's actually quite disheartening.
Right, exactly. Okay, well, Mr. Drayton, we're going to take a break here a minute, and we're going to open up the lines when we come back, take a station break, run a commercial or two, and we want to come back and take some questions from our audience, and then I want to get back into some things in our conversation. I want to talk about your essay, too, which very basically sets the stage for the book. I mean, I think you did a good job of doing that. And I really like that, the fact that you were able to, you know, to make that happen in that way. So, I mean, that's great. That's great. So we're going to take some questions from folk, and we'll come back, and we will open up the lines to talk. Okay?
Okie dokie. Thank you.
All right. You can fill up your teacup. Well, where you are, you're in Jersey. I was going to say, where you are, you probably got pineapple juice and mangoes.
Usually, yeah.
But you're in New Jersey, though, I forgot. Okay. All right, for right now. All right, let's take a break and we'll be right back.
Finley Medical Clinic. We serve uninsured, underinsured, and insured individuals. Open Monday through Thursday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Urgent care clinic Friday and Saturday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Call for an appointment at 414-988-3079. Finley Medical Clinic is accepting new patients. Vaccines and screenings for uninsured, underinsured, and insured. Located at 10721 West Capitol Drive, Suite 110. Call our office for an appointment today.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers. On Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Okay, we are back, sisters and brothers, living in America. That's what we're talking about tonight. And we have a wonderful guest, written a very powerful book, Miss Tiffany Drayton, from the beautiful sunshine country of Trinidad and Tobago. I never got to Trinidad. I've been to St. Martin, I've been to St. Lucia's, and Jamaica, and the Bermudas, in Bermuda, but never got to Trinidad. I would love that. I really would. It may be not too late. I might still do that one day.
Never too late. Never too late.
That's right. I just wanted to let our audience know that you can call us at area code 414-215-490-9832 if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment. I also want to let you know about the three other programs that we produce here on the Black Reality Think Tank. On Thursday evening, we produce a program called Warrior's Way, Continuing the Fight with Brother Kwasi Kraft. And that program airs Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. And you can go to the Time for an Awakening, with the Black Reality Think Tank Facebook page, and you can get the link if you would like to listen via the internet, or you can get the number from there, and you can also use the call-in format as well. But that's Warrior's Way. Continue the fight Thursday evening from 6 to 8 on the Blog Talk radio platform. And then on Saturday from 3 to 5, we have a program called Black Sister Talk. With LaWanda Chambers, that is also on the Blog Talk radio platform. And she deals with issues and things around women and millennials and mothers and parents. Wonderful conversation. Last week they talked about suicides, and wonderful discussion. And she is there every Saturday afternoon from 3 to 5. And again, you can go to the Black Reality Think Tank Facebook page, get the number or the link, and listen in the way that you would like to do so. So that's on Saturday. And then Saturday evening from 6 to 8 Central Time, and these are all Central Times, we have a program called the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee. And that program is hosted by Dr. Janine James and Brother Kwojo Robinson. And that is a program that deals with many community issues. Dr. James is an MD. She talks a lot about COVID and vaccinations and things of that nature and taking care of our health and our well-being. And so that's every Saturday evening from 6 to 8. And that is on Time for an Awakening platform, this platform. And you can simply call in here at 215-490-9832 and listen to that program as well. Okay, so let's do that. Those are our lineups, and I'm pretty sure you'll enjoy those as well. All right, next week here on the Black Reality Think Tank, we're going to go back to the East. We're going to be talking with the brothers and sisters from the East School, New York, out of New York. And we are going to be able to discuss and ask ourselves the questions about black institutions. What happened to it? If it was good and was so successful and doing all it was doing, why did it fail? Why did the community let that go down? And that's the conversation for next Tuesday, right here at Black Reality Think Tank from 7 to 9. We appreciate that. Okay, well, let's go to our lineup, Ms. Drayton, and we want to talk to some of our listeners who are here. I'm going to hook up with a good brother who's a fellow New Yorker. As a matter of fact, he used to drive those trains through New York. and he definitely knows about the city in tremendous ways, in particular that New Jersey area as well. So, Brother White, how you doing tonight?
Good evening, Dr. Rogers, and good evening to your guests.
Yes, sir. Any comments, any thoughts?
Yes, it's been very enlightening conversation tonight.
Thank you.
But I just like to point out that the European is very adept at exploiting every difference in the black community. Mm-hmm. Male, female, light skin, dark skin, educated, uneducated, uses every opportunity to turn one person against another, one group against another, mm-hmm. and whatnot. And these are the things that we have to undo among ourselves before we can get together to accomplish anything. Mm-hmm. Last week, we had a program on the prison industrial complex and mass incarceration. Mm-hmm. And we was discussing, you know, ways to combat that. Well, in the black community, it's difficult to get a lot of support because most people have been the victim of a crime. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to hear that. It's like, lock them up and throw away the key.
Lock them up, throw away the key. That's right.
You know, because they've been the victim of a crime, and they can't differentiate between the crime that was committed against them and the fact that we're talking about mass incarceration and the prison industrial complex, this something designed to destroy the black community. Mm-hmm. The media will show you a young man robbing a 75-year-old woman.
Yeah.
You know. Put him in jail and never let him out. Put him under the jail. So when you start talking about, you know, undoing that system, they don't want to hear it.
And I think that that's actually the power of refocusing the conversation to abuse and to everybody's role and participation in abuse opens up that space where we can have reconciliation. And where we can start having bigger conversations that allow for there to be healing. That's why I understand entirely what you're saying, and it's so absolutely true, because the truth is we're not in control of our narrative. We're not in control of...
Mr. Eaton?
...that we are going to actually be able to start afresh or even be able to come together is by creating this space where we are open to dialogue about abuse.
Yes.
No white people allowed.
No. Well, you see, there's levels to it because everybody's implicated differently. So that's why, in my understanding, when it comes to white people and white people's participation in and perpetuation of white supremacy, they need to be a part of that conversation. There's no argument about that. And we need to be holding white people to account. And also there needs to be some type of what I call reconciliatory justice, which is making amends and making sure that resources are redistributed in a way that we can actually, within our communities, start doing that healing work. Because yeah, we're all hurt. We are all damaged. We have been oppressed. We have hurt each other. These are facts of reality. But until we have resources to start doing that work, there's no way that we're ever going to heal. So if we refocus the conversation to healing, I think that's going to be really crucial in how we move forward with this dialogue.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you for that. Brother Lush, how you doing tonight? I haven't talked to you in a while. How you been?
Good evening, Dr. Rogers, and good evening, Ms. Drayton. It's a pleasure to hear from you. I'm just kind of curious, has your travels throughout the country brought you in the deep south, particularly Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and what are your thoughts in relationship to the book with regards to American Refugee? ideologies, et cetera?
Well, I've never lived in the states that you just labeled, but however, I have lived in Texas and I lived in Florida, and my family, we actually always traveled between Jersey by car and by bus all the way to Texas and even Florida. So there were some states that we just did not stop in. And many of those states that you just listed are those states. Why? Because we were in literal fear for our lives, and we knew that this is a matter of life and death to some extent. Like, just the looks that you get in certain states when you're at a rest stop, you know you probably shouldn't stop there. There are many states in the Deep South where we, even if you needed to use the bathroom, you just held it a little bit longer, but because you knew just how dangerous it is. So for me, coming into adulthood and recognizing all of these Black people who live in these states and what their fight means, it really makes that word refugee so much more poignant, because it applies in those areas so much more. I think it was just recently, I saw, not that recent, maybe like 2016, I saw a documentary, I think it was by Morgan Freeman, about a Mississippi school that still had a segregated prom.
Mm-hmm.
Was it Mississippi or Alabama? I'm not sure. But I was so horrified. But at the same time, it's just a reinforcement of what you already know. Like, these states really force you to grapple with what our status is in this country, and it's very scary.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Thank you. All the very best to you and your book, and I look forward to looking into it a little bit more as well.
Okay, thank you so much, Brother Les. I really appreciate that. I wanted to Mr. Drayton, I wanted to introduce another caller, but they just hung up. This is a brother that, has, like yourself, wanted to attempt to address the book, this circumstance. And he also wrote a book called Recapturing the African Mind, but he's hung up the phone, so we'll just go to somebody else. Brother Timothy, how you doing?
Oh, I'm good, sir. I like this scholarly person is presenting himself. And let me say this to you, sister. Indeed, I'm going to say to you, sister, that we had something in the mid-1995 that occurred, which is called the Million Man March.
Mm-hmm.
I always admired what this man did, you know. And, of course, you have people from different backgrounds that are Black. You have people from different states that are Black and from different countries that are Black. But he was able to bring men together on one accord and say a pledge that I pledge to not murder, steal within all the Black community that brings us down. And I said to myself how we could repeatedly do this, because you talked about the resources of the system. That's one thing. You use those. But what do we have amongst ourselves that we could pull our own self up? And you know what, man? I pointed myself in the direction that Dr. Rogers and a lot of the callers, when we talk to each other, we talk about these murders that are assisting in these states around the country. It's madness in Philadelphia. If we do over 500 from one year to the next, 1,000 youth from teenage to less than 30. If you put them in a parking lot, can you imagine 1,000 children that have not lived their life? So I'm saying, sometimes we have to stop, and somehow we got to stop to see how we can come together, like we're doing this phone, to see how we can prevention on all levels of murder, the lack of education, the lack of economics, and the lack of resources, and also knowing our country and the knowledge of ourselves, our motherland, our country name and flag.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I'd like to talk to you about that. We got to get this together, sister.
Well, certainly. I would say, in my opinion, however, though I recognize the importance of unity and advocacy within the Black community, my focus at this moment primarily is getting resources. Because you see dysfunction, and you see high murder rates, and you see domestic abuse and domestic violence and alcoholism and mental health issues in places that are impoverished, in places that are ghettoized. these are but symptoms of ghettoization. So the truth is, how do we actually cure the disease? You could go in and start filling in one program to feed kids, but the truth is, the ghettoization of these children is the actual disease that needs curing. So until we can come together and collectively agree on that target, which is this oppression, the system of oppression needs to stop. Not only does it need to stop, but there needs to be reconciliatory justice. There needs to be recompense. We need resources. If we can all agree on that direction primarily, then we can take those resources and start to ensure that our communities can be built in ways that are less dysfunctional and more wholesome and more and focus on education and all of these other things.
Great.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Brother Timothy. Appreciate that. Sister Ann, 919-477. You want to say something? Yeah, just listening.
No, I'm just listening.
Okay. Thank you so much. I always appreciate you listening. Let me go to Brother Kwasi Kraft, Warrior's Way, continuing the fight. Brother Kwasi, you got a question or comment?
Yes, a couple things. Well, one of the things you said, and thank you for having the guest, Ms. Tiffany Drayton. But you had said earlier, Dr. Rogers, you know, we need the black man and the black women. We need them to work together, and then we need our children to see them working together.
Right.
And I thought that was very important. But the other thing I wanted to ask Ms. Tiffany Drayton is that you talked about being organized and having common goals and so that we don't fight with people on their other, you know, people with different ideology. And have you witnessed that or seen that, you know, today in some way, shape, or form? I haven't got your book yet, but I'll get it tomorrow.
next Tuesday.
I think it's actually a really, really fantastic question, and it's actually one that has been popping up in my own interpersonal conversations all the time, because I am actually witnessing this huge shift in the way that in my own personal relationships. So, for example, one of the themes of my book is this sense of isolation, right? Because I was an immigrant in this country. I didn't really have a lot of friends or family, or I was always kind of sort of doing everything on my own. And I thought that was just a matter of being an immigrant, but I realized, no, that's actually the end result of being in a society where meritocracy and escaping blackness is the only means by which we can find success, right? So isolation is actually a component of success for many black people. So when I kind of sort of realized that, I started being a little more open to making myself less isolated. Mm-hmm. But I didn't take any action myself. People around me actually started to create groups. And right now, like as we speak, there are so many groups that are blossoming like organically, whether it be these online communities that are organized around particular goals, or even how you saw, we were talking about the voting situation in Georgia. That was a completely grassroots movement. And so there is so much organized, or even how you're seeing right now, all of these workers that are organizing and organizing strikes and all the stuff you don't see on TV every day.
Right.
The organization of people is happening as we speak. You want to know why? Because people are feeling that squeeze. People are realizing that this concept of individuality and meritocracy is failing us. And it's failing us. And because of that, we need the support system that previously we would not have really thought were that important. So my answer to you is, it is happening right now, for sure. There is no doubt about it. And as we watch the era progress, and as things get harder and harder and harder, you're going, and even as these shifts happen in how we're working and what we're willing to do for work, you're going to start seeing that even your own family units are probably getting stronger. Even your own communities are starting to kind of coalesce around need. So it's one of those inevitabilities of the era, but we need to push that inevitability beyond just us meeting basic needs. We need to come around big goals for ourselves and also start making big demands, because this is the era of come with the demands, for
sure. Right. Beautiful.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Kwasi. Appreciate it. Newbert, North Carolina, 252-474. How you doing tonight, my brother?
Doing fine, brother. Good show.
How you doing? Thank you. Any questions or thoughts you have?
Oh, yeah. Two. She just finished with Big Demand. That's a show by itself. I'd like for her to allude to that a little bit more. And if she would, I don't know if she got anything in it on the books. What about the blacks that sometimes got the jobs that, I don't know, the young people speak about this to me a lot, you know, me working in the, out here in the community, about the blacks that stand in our way. I won't say much past that. If she could speak, if you both you guys could speak to that. Thanks for bringing me in.
With regards to Big Demand, there are some things that I'm currently focused on that I think are really, really crucial in meeting the moment that is befalling us. One of those big issues is clearly the issue of mass incarceration, especially for nonviolent offenses. You know, you kind of brought that up earlier. And the truth is, as we see all of these huge shifts that are happening in our tech, for example, we want to move into this green era and this era of sustainability and clean energy, right? Well, what does that require? That requires manpower. And that's just a fact. We need to be deconstructing and reconstructing. And in order to do that, we need people who are capable of operating machinery. And we need manpower. So in my opinion, there is absolutely no reason why we should continue to incarcerate people for things like weed, which is now a multi-billion dollar industry. And not only should they not be incarcerated, but they should be moving into new industries and being given opportunities to participate in sustainability projects and agriculture projects and new tech and green tech. So mm-hmm. if we are focused on organizing these populations of people that we even look down on as a community, like how you were describing earlier, you know, it's like when people are harmed by crime, now all of a sudden it's like lock them up, throw away the key. No. We need to recognize that these are people who actually have potential to help us to drive our community in the direction that's necessary for us to survive as a humanity and to sustain any type of future in this new era of tech, in this new era of green energy, and in this new era of even possible food crises, right? So that's one little tiny example of mm-hmm. many of the big demands that we should really be thinking about moving into this new era. The second question, I don't quite remember. If you could just ask me again.
I was talking about a lot. I get a lot from some of the young kids and others that while we're working about some of the blacks that have the good positions and mm-hmm. you go to them or we run into them and they stand in the way, so to speak. You know, they... Mm-hmm. You understand what's wrong with that?
Oh, yeah. The gatekeepers, that's what I call them. You know, it's the truth of the matter is there's no such thing as a good position. Because if you are in a society where just purely based on your skin pigmentation, the police are going to stop you when you pull into that expensive neighborhood, well, then are you really living the high life? No, you're not. So these people who operated as gatekeepers in these spaces, many of them, you know, black people like ourselves who, you know, had some high paying positions or whatever, who would have said, nah, this person's not going to come in because their pants are sagging, or that person, you know, policing people for their dress or how they talk, any number of things. These types of behaviors, in my opinion, are going to diminish over time, because in order for black people to truly confront the moment, they too will have to recognize that in spite of all of the riches, I can't even say wealth, because it's mostly just riches. In spite of all of that, blackness still puts you in this second class citizenry position mm-hmm. that we must abolish that. And, you know, whether you're seeing it, look at the guy in the NFL. You know, this guy is vying to be a head coach in the NFL. He makes good money, but he is putting all of that on the line as we speak to simply say, I deserve any opportunity that a white person gets as well. I deserve to have a fair chance to have that opportunity. And he is risking his entire career and his entire livelihood to make that stance. And he's not the only one. So whatever issues we've had of the past, of these people who were maybe gatekeeping or, you know, who cares? Moving forward, this is a new era. And we have to stick on, we have to stick to looking in that forward direction.
Beautiful. Great. Great. Okay. Thank you, my brother from Newbern. Appreciate it. Brother Griffin, you got a question? A comment?
Oh, yeah. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, yeah, I hadn't talked to you in a while. I didn't get the young lady's full name. I was trying to make sure of what I'm going to look for the researcher.
Tiffany Drayton, and that's spelled Drayton, D-R-A-Y-T-O-N.
And the name of the book is what?
You want to give them all the full details, Tiffany?
Yeah.
Oh, the name of the book is Black American Refugee, Escaping the Narcissism of the American Dream. You can find it on any platform, Amazon, Google, Target, Walmart. Also, if you can just type it in Google, it'll pop up even on the Penguin website, penguinrandomhouse.com.
And good. I loved your presentation tonight, but I also want to make sure I can send you some information because I heard you say some information about ADOS, and I actually know well how that group was formulated. I'm going to say this to you. The best way I can give you an example of what the premise of ADOS was, is Dr. Shirley Weber, the representative from California that sponsored AB 3121.
Mm-hmm.
It took her 3 years to come around to the specificity of the fact that ADOS was what started around the idea that reparations in the United States of America has to be specific to the lineage of people who come from enslaved chattel slaves in America. I happen to be one of those that is here in the county they were born in, and I'm 68 years old. I heard your story talking about trauma, but I'm going to say something to you. It is known throughout the world that oppression and poverty create dynamics that make people do what? Crimes of opportunity, which means black people have a lot of interpersonal balance. I happen to have raised a single son after becoming a father at 40 because of the trauma that what happens in this country puts on American families.
Mm-hmm.
But I do not ascribe to the dysfunctional Negro syndrome. In other words, what I'm saying to you is, once we get the federal government to honor what it did when we had freedmen and Reconstruction was black people prospering, and in this country, there's a backlash called white backlash, lost cause teaching, the very essence of what built this country. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say to you, we here in America, from the Randall Roberts days right on up to apartheid in South Africa, have no excuses and no apologies to any black people around the world other than to say, this particular reparations fight is about us, and we still embrace all black people across the world. Have a good night.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, Brother Griffin. Appreciate that. let me go to Milwaukee, 414-507.
Hey, Doc. How you doing?
Fine. Doing great. Any questions or comments, my brother? How you doing?
I'm doing good. Listening to the show.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah, I'm just listening, though. I'm thinking about what she's talking about. And I did Google her. I got the information. I'm going to order the book.
Great. Yeah, I don't think you'll be sorry. You did. It's an excellent piece. Really a good piece. Yeah.
All right. I appreciate you. Appreciate your show and your guests.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it very much. Okay, right. Tiffany, let me... I got one other call I want to... I got two other ones. Albuquerque, New Mexico, 505. Question or comment? Albuquerque, New Mexico, 505-340. Okay, I guess you're just listening. Greensboro, North Carolina. I don't see a number, I just see Johnson. Yes.
Brother?
Oh, yes, hi, how you doing?
Okay, peace. How are you?
Wonderful.
Good, 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 good. Greetings to you. Greetings to your guest. I've heard some dialogue that was so on point, and so I'm just taking it all in. But I want to make a couple of comments.
Okay.
One is the sister. Remind me of your name again, sister.
Tiffany Drayton.
Tiffany Drayton, yeah. I'm glad to see that you've gotten so much support. You know, this is the importance of black media. I want to stress that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've gotten some excellent support, and I'm happy to see us doing this for each other.
Mm-hmm.
So you talked about, you mentioned two things. One was the abusive relationship syndrome, and that is so on point. And I don't know if you mentioned, you know, this word, but I want to just remind us all that this is a forced relationship. We didn't enter into this relationship with the Europeans. You know, we didn't decide, oh, let's go and be slaves in America.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't our decision. And so that's what makes it worse. And the abusiveness of it, actual savagery. So since we became property, and we continue to be used for labor. That requires something really, really drastic. And I think you alluded to that earlier too. I'll just say with this, that saying that, you know, drastic situations call for drastic measures, something like that. And and so you talked about internalized, you mentioned the word internalized, and I always talk about internalized oppression and how when someone is abused or a group is abused for so long, you internalize those messages that come from the abuse. You know, the low self-esteem, learned powerlessness, you know, all of those things, even denial that you're actually in an abusive relationship, which a lot of us are suffering from. So, so I, you know, I've been an organizer for a very long time, and I've come to the conclusion that because this is extremely, extremely abusive and it's getting worse, and if we're honest with ourselves, you can't change a predator. And Europeans have a predatory gene or something, but it's global. It's global. And so we can't change them, but we can change ourselves. And that's why I hear you talking about that, too. And so in a sense of healing, you know, and inner change, the internal change, it does require some separation from the predator. So we can look at our own issues and heal amongst ourselves, because we're not going to be able to heal with somebody who's preying on us. But we really need to get busy, because I'll end with this. We're living our lives in a sociopath's playground.
Mm-hmm.
And every time we play according to the rules, they change the rules, they change the game. You know, things are always changing up on us. And one of the last pieces I saw was that, I don't know if any of you have heard of this, there's another, I think it's like the third white city or state, whatever, where they've elected a neo-Nazi local government.
Lord have mercy.
So, and you've heard of that, Doc?
Yes, I have.
Okay. So while we're having our dialogues and writing our books and whatnot, which we need, we absolutely need them, they're building towns. They're going back to this Jim Crow era where they want complete control. And they've said very clearly, we'll do it or everybody will die. So I'm thinking now, I said all that to say, I'm at a point now where I'm thinking, I want to get up out of here. Because this insanity will not stop, because, again, we're living our lives in a sociopath playground.
Right.
So I'm going to check your book out too, sis, and thanks for sharing.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your analysis and for the point that you're making to that. And I really want to stress and agree with the point that you were making, like, the reality of it is, the sad part of this thesis of America being an abuser is that it's true, you can't actually change a predator. So then what does that say for us living within the confines of this reality? Well, the truth is, we have only one choice, and that's to fight. Right. And however you have the means, one of the, it's really interesting. I was doing an interview with USA Today, and the interviewer asked me, well, what do you say to all of the African American people who don't have anywhere else to go to, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, this question gave me pause, because this narrative of powerlessness of African American people is so interesting. And I said to him, I'm like, do you realize America has one of the strongest passports in the world? Like, we constantly diminish the power of African Americans as Americans. And part of that is because America's oppression is so, so substantial. But the truth is, Black Americans still hold a position of power in the global world.
Yes,
and that power, we must harness. Because without doing so, the reality of it is, this oppressive system is truly inescapable, if you want to be honest. No matter where you move, mm-hmm. it may find you there. Mm-hmm. But with that said, when it comes to my perception of the next 5 years, 10 years, this is a very tenuous and dangerous situation. And I say that every single day. Me personally, when Trump was elected and even the white people were like, I'm moving to Canada, I'm leaving, I was just nodding my head because it's becoming dire. So in my opinion, I feel like everybody should have a passport at this point, because we, as much as we need to fight, we need to draw a line between our, like, being alive and not being alive. Like, where does that end, and when does it become a matter of self-preservation? Right. And do you have the tools necessary to preserve your life and your family's life, keep yourself safe?
I like that. I love that. Okay, thank you so much. Tiffany, Trinidad, Tobago, what is CARICOM? What is that? Who owns that? Who controls CARICOM? And for our audience, CARICOM is that economic arm.
Yeah, CARICOM is a body, is a political body that unites the Caribbean, and I think it's led currently by the Prime Minister of Trinidad and Tobago, Keith Rowley.
Right. So when you were coming back, you were leaving America, coming back to Trinidad. Were you going from the fire to the furnace?
No, definitely. Well, that's a
Okay.
You see, the situation with the pandemic being a global crisis on multiple levels, whether it be a health crisis, an economic crisis, this has implications for the rest of the world.
Right.
And what they say, is like, when America sneezes, the rest of the world gets cancer. And that there is some truth in that at this point.
Exactly.
When we sit with what an economy that is dependent on oil and gas, which is Trinidad and Tobago, or an economy dependent on tourism, which is most of the Caribbean,
mm-hmm.
what can we make of these economies moving forward into this new era? Right, where we're moving away from oil and gas, and where we have closed borders and sickness and illness that's going to have major impacts on tourism, right? So that's why I'm saying part of the fight is a fight of self-preservation. You need to get wherever you can get to and heal and have that moment for yourself. But the bigger fight is a global fight against this beast, and the beast is not just America as a country, it's America as a globalized system, and it's white supremacy as a globalized system.
Right.
And until we have some sense of unity, and as I said before, shared goals, and when I say shared goals, I don't mean just America. I mean the entire Western Hemisphere, every person of color, not just the Western Hemisphere, Africa. The climate crisis in Africa means that people are going to starve. It means that as we speak, people are starving, actually,
mm-hmm.
because places don't have enough water, or they're being flooded out. There's so many extreme weather patterns that are the result of our consumption in the United States of America and our consumption in the Western Hemisphere and rich countries like Trinidad and Tobago. So ultimately, we need a globalized perspective in order to tackle the issues of the future, as much as we need to be looking at America as an abusive system, too. it's like a twofold thing that we must do.
Mm-hmm. Great. You know, the reason I kind of asked that question, and you know, I had done some work in it, as we had talked earlier, you know, it's just kind of something that somebody might bring to mind. Did you, you know, is there anywhere you can go and get away from white supremacy? And obviously you said no, you can't. But also I was thinking about one of your neighbors in Trinidad, the Trinidadian neighbor, which is Venezuela. And I remember what America was doing and what they are still doing in Venezuela to attempt to try to control that oil and gas. And some of all of that. So the cost of living for that area, how is that for folk? Is that something off the wall because of that oil? Because I know, like, you get places here, like in Houston, and down where those big oil wells are, it's, the cost of living is off the wall. What about that?
Right. Well, you know, first I'll answer that question, and I really want to kind of also shed a little bit of light to what being in Trinidad means for me and means for my family as people of color, as black people. So the first part of your question is, of course, anywhere you have oil and gas as an economy, there's ridiculous inflation. And that's true of Trinidad. The inflation is so obscene that it's almost laughable. Like, it's either you laugh or you cry.
Right.
So that's a fact. But beyond a matter of economics is the absence of that daily white gaze and pervasive policing. Mm-hmm. You know, just being in a country where everybody looks like you or something close to it, and being able to operate in a society where you can do that, where you can move freely without fear that, okay, because I look this way, I can't walk through this neighborhood, or because my kids look this way, they can't go to this park. Right, being able to live outside of the confines of that constant indignity, it's so healing and so liberating and so exciting, and has really brought me so much peace and so much joy and so much happiness. And that's really part of that healing process that I try to describe in the book, because people think it's like, oh, I get up and I leave America and everything is great. No, that's not true. No matter where we go, we are committed to this fight. Exactly. We're committed to eradicating globalized white supremacy. But that doesn't mean that we don't deserve a moment to breathe and enjoy the collective beauty of blackness and brownness.
Right.
And that could happen anywhere. That can happen in a black neighborhood. And, you know, it happened in Harlem during the Harlem Renaissance.
That's true.
It can happen in a football game down south with the black marching bands and with black dancers, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there's any number of ways that black people can find those spaces, and even how there are HBCUs and how there's this resurgence of people recognizing how important they are, not just the scholarship, but to this point, to this sense of safety. So creating and fostering safe space for blackness and for black joy and for expression and for art and for culture, that's really what's going to sustain us.
Beautiful.
And that's a effort that, like, it doesn't matter where you go.
Mm-hmm. Is that kind of the energy behind those beautiful festivals you all have?
Oh, God, yeah.
I know. I've seen some of that. Boy, I just faint every time I see it. It's so beautiful. I love it.
And really, you know, we can't end this conversation without talking about Carnival, because it's like right around Carnival time. And I'm having a hard time sleeping at night because Carnival is canceled again, pretty much.
Okay.
And it's like, because, you know, the coronavirus and Carnival for Caribbean people was just this explosion of black happiness and freedom, you know, just people dancing in the street. We don't care what white people are. There's no white people watching. If they're watching, you go back to your country. You know, you can say that. You're free to say that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody's policing your behavior, telling you what to do, what to not do. You're there to enjoy yourself and participate in the way that you do as a black person in the Western Hemisphere, and you're free to do that.
Right.
And that's really what I try to bring to life in my book, and that's part of that rebirth of myself as a black woman, that it's not just a matter of, you know, borders and countries and nationality. It's really just this beauty of self-expression and owning that self-expression outside of the confines of, like, it being appropriated, like how, you know,
this music industry just insists on appropriating and destroying black culture in America. Lord. But yes.
Yeah, beautiful. Now, I know you when we talked earlier in the week, you mentioned the fact that you were getting ready to work on your next book, which is going to deal with the prison industrial complex. Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay. You want to build a little bit of it? I know you don't want to go too much of it because you haven't written it yet, but what are you trying to do? What are you looking at in doing this book?
Well, for my next book, I really want to expand the conversation to an entire critique of capitalism as a whole system.
Right.
And its infiltration of various industries. So whether it be the prison industrial complex, whether it be the court system and the family court system. So the book is really going to give me an opportunity to have further reach on conversations that are more expansive outside of just race, because of course we need to start having bigger conversations, because this is not just a matter of even racism. This is a matter of, like, are we going to deal with climate change? Are we going to pivot away from these dirty energy sources that are literally destroying our planet? You know, so we have these huge existential crises that we have to once again begin mobilizing. And this is across race, this is across age, because we need to view these things as a call to action outside of ideology. This is just a fact. We have to be united as a front against continuing down this path that's going to destroy everything that we love.
Right. Exactly. I know in your essay that you wrote for the New York Times, I know you talked about education a lot. And you mentioned the fact that, you know, in terms of your own indoctrination and how you were looking for answers and what you were trying to do, and the fact that, you know, you learned buzzwords that means poor education and things like that that people would say. I wanted to ask you, you said you wrote two children's books. What were you doing in those books? What were you attempting to do? When did you write, first of all, when did you write those? Did you write those recent, is that a recent publications?
They're actually young adult books, which is a little bit older than children.
Something about gun violence, something, right?
Yeah. So they're two different books. One was about developing leadership skills, and the other one was about coping with gun violence.
Okay.
And they're a part of like a series of books to help young people navigate these really, really difficult subject matters and these really heavy, hard, you know, issues. So, well, not so much the developing political leadership skills, but the coping with gun violence. So I was really motivated to write those books because, you know, young people are, like, look at the gun crisis we're dealing with in schools. No child should have to go to school and be afraid that they're gonna get, you know, violently shot up in their class. But that's the reality of America. And it's not just in schools, it's in the homes, it's everywhere. So that spurs the need for this type of literature, which I wish we didn't need, but ultimately we do, and that's how those books were born.
Yeah. And the one on gun violence is just, it's just sort of a warning to young people, an awareness kind of wake-up thing. Is that what you were doing?
Yeah, it's really just, it's actually a manual to help them learn how to cope if they've lost a loved one to gun violence, if they've been exposed to gun violence. So it's really just a manual to help them cope and to learn to really recognize that they're not alone in that experience, and that it's something that, you know, is so pervasive at this point that they have a community, and part of that, part of being connected to that community is reading the book, and the book gives resources in the back for kids who've been exposed.
Yeah, I would like to see that in the hands of a lot of children. I'm going to take a look at that one, the gun book. Is that a Barnes & Noble or Amazon thing? They got that too?
You know, I'm not sure anymore, because I think it was published for schools primarily.
Okay. Well, I'll look for it.
So I'm not sure what they're selling it, but you can probably get it online somewhere.
Okay, I'll definitely look for it. Okay, now we've got about 6 minutes left. I want you to kind of, close up. Was anything you want to say about your book or, some of the discussion that we've had? I really appreciate you. This has been a very rich discussion, and it really gives us something to take away with. And that's important. I always want something that we can walk away with, that we can remember. So give us anything that you want us to remember, know, that's important, you know, in what we've discussed today.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most important takeaway from this whole conversation and even from my book is just, as I said before, like really focusing on the abuse that we have faced and also that we contribute to, and taking ownership of that and being accountable for our own behaviors and holding other people accountable for theirs, and simultaneously making space to heal, and demanding accountability and demanding recompense, because that's really truly the only way forward. But aside from that, it's just, I am truly, truly, truly just enamored with this era that we're moving into that really has so much glimmers of hope buried in the rubble of all types of tumult and all types of torture, of course. A bunch of political discourse that is disheartening and economic discourse that's very disheartening. But beyond all of that, the light at the end of the tunnel is in this rebirth, is in the sense that we can actually come out of this if we are unified with a country and with a planet that is cleaner, mm-hmm. with a country and with a planet that, you know, has shared goals towards sustainability and towards the respect of nature, these really fundamental values that as a humanity we should share. So I would say the last thing that I want to say is that, like, we must really refocus our energy and attention to our collective humanity and being brothers and sisters and mothers to one another across demographics, across demographics, across gender, across anything, across ideology. Exactly. We're pretty much each other's keeper at this point. Mm-hmm. So humanity is just the number one thing.
Right. All right. Well, this has been, as I said, real rich and very rewarding. I hope our audience has been able to gain something from this. We appreciate our patronage from our audience. It's been a wonderful conversation. Now, I know the book is due to be released on next Tuesday, and so give everybody a chance to get it and folks to read it for a little while, and then I want to come back and yank you up again if you let me. At some point.
For sure.
Yes, indeed.
And everyone can find me on social media. My name is Tiffany Drayton. On Twitter, I'm at Drayton Tiffany. Okay. And that's also my handle on Instagram. So you can hit me up and send me messages, ask me any questions.
Okay. Say that again, because I know somebody had wanted to know how they can contact you. Say, give it to us once more.
So on Facebook, it's Tiffany, TiffAnie, Drayton. And then on Instagram and Twitter, my handle is at Drayton Tiffany.
Okay. All right. And again, thank you. And this has been really rewarding. And make sure we keep in touch. And I want to see how the book's doing. And once we get another, we'll come back at it from another direction and and talk about some
thank
other
you
different
for
things.
Having me.
All right. Thank you all to our audience for being here, and we appreciate your patience, your questions, your comments. I had one other brother that I really wanted you to meet, but he came on, went off. He had written a book called Recapturing the African Mind, and I thought maybe he might want to share some things with you, but I'm not sure where he is. So anyway, thank you so much, Tiffany. Have a good week, and I will talk with you hopefully very soon, okay?
Alrighty. You too.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.